So, before we get to the T, just a brief word on the origin of this word. Tulip was not created by John Calvin. The popular caricature, the straw man argument, is that John Calvin created a system of doctrine that we call Calvinism. Much like Luther, John Calvin would have hated that a movement has his name on it. Luther even said, I think, something to this spirit that Calvin owned, because Luther was viewed among the reformers as the father of the Reformation. Calvin even says this in a few of his books. We must honor our father Luther in his teaching. He was very respectful, very humble toward Martin's work. But Luther, one time when he discovered that they were thinking about coining the term Lutheranism, said, I am a wandering planet, a wandering star. No one should name anything after me. Calvin had the same spirit. So he was not a fan of Calvinism. He did not write to create Calvinism. So where then does the name come from? In 1618, so a whole 70 to 80 years after the death of Calvin, in the 16th century, we're now into the 17th century, so right at 1618, in Holland, so the Dutch church had been influenced by the teaching of the reformers, specifically John Calvin's teaching. Remember, there's no separation of church and state at the time. And so the government of Holland for the Dutch church made a lot of the Reformation teaching their nationwide standards for belief. It's a different world than we live in today, right? This is the normal. If you're a Dutch citizen, it's almost synonymous that you are a Reformation person. You're a Calvinist before even the word was out there. In 1618, in a Dutch seminary, there was a professor named Jacobus Arminius. He was a beloved seminary professor, taught many students in the years he was teaching. I'm not sure of the name of the seminary, but his students loved him, the faculty loved him, the towns around there loved him, he'd travel around and preach, beloved figure that disagreed with much of the Reformation teaching. Well, he lived, he taught, he died, he had a legacy in a lot of his students. His students got together. They were a little sick and tired of the state teaching in the church in Holland at that time that's so reformed and reformational doctrine. They wanted, he kind of formed this group, to protest the government with regard to the beliefs of the Dutch church. So they formed together and wanted to do this kind of protest, and they were called the Remonstrants. That was their name. It's just the Dutch word for protest, the Remonstrants. So they came to the government in, I believe, 1616-ish, 1617, with their protest. They said, we want you, hear us, we want you to change. Remember, this is the students of Jacobus Arminius. We want you to change the state teachings to be more in line with our beloved professor Arminius. And they were like, well, what do you have in mind? They said, we want five things to change. The doctrine of sin, the doctrine of predestination, the doctrine of the atonement, doctrine of grace, and doctrine of perseverance. We want these things to change. And so the Remonstrants, the protesters, drew up their teaching, presented them to the state church. They then took 2 years, it's government, right? That's not changed, to review these things and to slowly go through them. So they called a synod, S-Y-N-O-D, a big meeting of theologians and pastors and government officials at the time, because that's overlap, right, for a state-run church. The synod met in the city of Dort, so it was called the Synod of Dort. It started in November 13th of 1618, and it went all the way to to about a full year, and they convened in 1618, finished in 1619, I believe in April or May, right around our time now. They, after reviewing the teachings of the Remonstrants and their beliefs after their beloved professor Arminius, the state church, the Synod of Dort, decided to not only reject the five notions of correction that these Remonstrants were bringing forward, but they said, we need to do more than just correct. We have to state our own five statements that are something of a response to our citizens so they understand something more of our position. These five statements had to do with total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and perseverance of the saints. It was not at that time so neatly called so it could form the word tulip. That came later on in history as it got popularized into modern culture, as it came over the pond into the Americas and things like this. But they then rejected the views of the what came to be known, the Arminians, after their beloved professor Arminius. And they said, our teachings are actually more in line with the reformers like John Calvin. So this is the origin, where it began, the feud between the Calvinists and the Arminians. It was the Synod of Dort, a generation or two after John Calvin had already died, where this fanned into flame and this word is created. Calvin didn't write this. His descendants did, in defense against the pupils of Arminius coming to them. So if anyone ever asks you, I don't like Calvin because he came up with Calvinism, you're like, hold on, time out. It's not fair. He didn't do this. It was actually in response to Arminians that this whole word was even created to bring clarity to an issue that they did not want fog around. So that's the history of the origin of tulip. Well, let's begin the tea. As we begin the tea tonight for total depravity, I want you to get a mental picture in your head of a lion in a cage. Picture a lion in a cage. Before this lion, you see two bowls, a bowl of meat and a bowl of wheat. Tell me, which one will the lion choose to eat? The meat. Good job. Why? They're carnivorous. They're meat eaters. They don't eat salad. Salad is the thing that their food eats, right? They're meat eaters. They're not vegetarians. The lion will always choose the meat, never choose the wheat, because lions don't do this because of their nature. It's in their nature. Now ask a deeper question now. What would have to happen to the lion for the lion to desire the wheat? Or ask it in a different way. What would have to happen to the lion so that he desired something alien to his natural preference? And the answer, I think the only answer, his nature would have to be changed. His nature would have to be changed. And that is something the lion cannot do really ever. He certainly can't do it himself. My aim tonight in talking to you about the tea and tulip on total depravity is to persuade you that salvation, as it's described in the Bible, is just like that lion in the cage. It's just like it. Our depravity, our sinful nature, will only and ever choose what it desires, and a sinful nature will only desire and choose sin. So as the lion only eats meat, sinners, when given a choice between righteousness and sin, will only choose sin. So naturally a question comes, just like we asked with the lion, what would have to happen to the nature of a sinner to get the sinner to desire something alien to its natural preference? the sinner's nature would have to be changed. That is what happens in regeneration and conversion, the new birth. A new heart is given with new desires, desires that are not natural to us as sinners. This is what happens in the gospel, and only God can change the heart. So you see, the Bible... hold on, something tickling me. The Bible does not present a will in man that is neutral, being able to choose one way or another. But rather, a will is presented that's dead and in bondage to sin until God makes it new. So, let me challenge you here just at the start. On one hand, if we reject total depravity, it's nothing more, I think, than an arrogant assault on the sovereign grace of God. But if we embrace the doctrine of total depravity, our sinful state, it paves the way for the best news in the world, the gospel of grace that actually changes us. That's what's at stake. And whether or not we affirm or deny this doctrine. So, when we turn to the Bible, we find the Bible speaks about total depravity, our depraved state, in five terms. You could say the first term is guilt. The Bible speaks a lot about our guilt. When our first parents were deceived in the garden and took a bite from the forbidden fruit, they plunge the entire human race into guilt and condemnation. Paul explains this in Romans 5, where he says, "Just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, so death spread to all men because all sinned." And so the point here is that the relationship between Adam and us is so close that God includes that phrase at the end of 5:12, chapter 5, verse 12. Death spread to all men, not because Adam sinned, but because all sinned. Adam then functions as the representative head for all humanity. As goes the head, so goes the body. As goes the representative, so goes all this head is representing. We follow suit. Because of this, at the moment of our conception, not even birth, before that, we are conceived not as neutral or innocent men and women that can choose right or wrong. We are conceived guilty and sinful before we can ever commit actual sin. This is why God says earlier in Romans 3:23, "For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God." Because though we were made in God's image, we've chosen to exchange the glory of God for our glory, distorting God's image in us. We had life, life to the full, walking with God in the cool of the day. All was as it should be. But we rebelled. Rebelled against the King of Kings, the just judge of all the universe, and this is nothing, therefore, short of cosmic treason. Guilt is how the Bible describes us. Another term we could use is darkness. Darkness describes us. John 3:19 and 20 says, "This is the judgment. The light has come into the world, but people love the darkness rather than the light, because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his work should be exposed." John 8:12, where Jesus is called the light of the world. John says light entered the dark world, and surprisingly, we didn't just prefer darkness over the light. John says we love the darkness over the light. This is not a lifeless choice, as if we would make somewhere sitting here or there, on this side of the room or that side of the room. This is an emotionally loaded heart assessment. Not just that we chose darkness, we loved darkness. The issue with ourselves as sinners is not that we choose to sin, it's that we love sin. We love to sin. No one, therefore, falls into sin. We sin even at a subconscious level. Everyone sins because they want to. They're making a choice. And so our natural state, born into this world, conceived into this world, we love darkness, hate the light, love sin, hate Jesus. Why? Because our deeds are evil, John says, and we don't want our wickedness to be broadcast to the whole world by coming to the light, so we remain in the darkness that is so comfortable to us. Later on in the New Testament, we can even get more darkness imagery. It identifies us with darkness. I wonder if you ever noticed Paul's choice of words in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 8. I'll begin in verse 7. Do not become partakers with sons of disobedience, for at one time you were darkness. Did you notice that? At one time, Paul did not say you were in darkness, for at one time you were darkness. But now you are light in the Lord. If you read John 3, what we just read earlier, along with this verse in Ephesians 5, 8, you get something like this. Darkness is not just something we're in, and it's not even something just that we love. Darkness describes who we are as sinners. We are by nature darkness. This is sinful man. Guilt, darkness, third term, hatred. Hatred. Romans 8, 5 to 8 shows this. I'm going to, some of you are former teachers, I'm going to use an example that I was once told in a class. I'll get there. In Romans 8, verse 5 to 8, Paul says this, describing the difference between living with a mind set on wicked things and a mind set on things of the Spirit. Paul says, for those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh. But those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. For to set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God. It does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. Those who are in the flesh cannot please God. So what is the sinner's natural posture toward God? Is it one of peace, indifference, or neutrality? No. Far from it, the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God. This word hostile means hostility. It literally hates God, is at enmity with God. So natural man is this. All those who have not been raised to life by the power of the Spirit hate God, are alienated from God, and are at odds with God. Now, the example. We all perhaps were there at one time or another around second to fourth grade when we asked our teacher, "Can I go to the bathroom?" And the teacher responded with, there you go. That's it. Oh, the homeschooler got it. Come on, guys. Can I go to the bathroom? The teacher responds, I don't know. Can you? And they're trying to get us to say, may I go to the bathroom? Teaching us a monumentally historic reformed theological point whether or not they know this is going on at the time. This is what it shows. May is a term of permission. Can is a term of ability. Can I go to the bathroom? Of course you can. I don't know. Can you? It's all about what we're able or not able to do, right? May is a term of permission. Back to Romans 8, verse 8. We cannot please God. This is a term of ability. The natural sinner's lack of ability to please God is something of the essence of the sin nature of the sinner, which is why a few chapters earlier in Romans 3, Paul, quoting the Psalms, says, "None is righteous, not one. No one understands. No one seeks God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one." So we saw guilt, we saw darkness, we saw hatred. Let's just keep going with these wonderfully encouraging words. The fourth, death. Death. Ephesians 2 begins with this statement. "And you were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath like the rest of mankind." Many people speak of our sin nature, especially it's very popular these days in the evangelical general Protestant world to speak of sin as if it's brokenness. True. As if it's woundedness. True. The scriptures go further. We are dead. So the image that comes to mind is not somebody that fell off a boat and is unable to really swim. They don't have the ability to. So they're sitting there just clawing at the water, trying to get to the life preserver that someone threw out to them. And everyone's just on the side, just hoping, wishing upon a star that they'd get to the preserver. That's not man in sin. The picture we have of man in sin, if we pay attention to the Bible, is, "And you were dead." You're not scurrying around on the surface of the water. You're on the bottom with lungs filled with water. This is the picture. It's Lazarus in his tomb with no life. This is our sinful state. Not on the brink of death, not in a hospital bed, almost. We are 6 feet under. And this is not an individual assessment. This is a universal assessment. We are by nature children of wrath like the rest of mankind. Yet, ironically, it says that we, though dead in sin, walk according to the course of the world. So you know what this makes us, as sinners, the walking dead. That's what we are as sinners. By birth, that's what we are. Following the course of the world, the prince of the power of the air. So what terms have we seen so far? We saw guilt. We saw darkness, hatred, death. Our last term, blindness. This is our depraved state, blindness. 2 Corinthians 4:4, Paul says, "The God of this world," lowercase g, this is Satan, "has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God." Here, we see Satan's work, blinding all those who don't believe, keeping them from seeing not just the light, and not even just the light of the gospel, but he blinds the eyes of the unbelievers from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. There's light, there's gospel, and there's a person. in whom all of this stuff is held, the source of the light. The unbelievers can't see it. This is why Jesus and Nicodemus, their conversation in John 3, in verse 3, Jesus said, "No one can see the kingdom of God unless they're born again." If you're not born again, you can't see as you ought to see. This means there's glory to be seen in the gospel, the glory of Christ, and if we see him, it will stun our souls, fill us with pleasure and exuberance beyond measure. Yet, by conception, by nature, we're blind to beauty. So, that's blindness. Our radical corruption, or you could say our total depravity, both are appropriate terms, is described in these five words: guilt, darkness, hatred, death, and blindness. That's us. I remember thinking through these things for the first time and grappling with them and talking with Holly's grandmother at the time. She made a side comment about someone on TV or someone that we were talking about that like made a mistake in life. And Holly's grandmother, Mama is what we called her, she said, what'd they say, babe? I'm blanking. Oh my gosh. There goes the illustration. Bless his heart. Or now it was like, they've got such a pure heart. That's what she said. We were talking about something, and that's what she said. And I remember looking at her, and I said, "Mama!" I said, "That's not true." And she looked at me, and she went like this. "You really want to go there?" Young little 27-year-old man at the time. And I said, "Mama, no one's heart is pure. The Bible says so." And she said, "I know, sweetie, I know. You know what I meant." I said, "I know, I know." Perhaps some of you are thinking, after these five words, what about free will and man's freedom in general? I understand why some of you would go there, but I want you to see two quick things before we start to apply this and then open it up for discussion and Q&A. Free will, first, is not something that works in our favor. Our will is the source of the problem. Remember the lion in the cage? By their nature, in their freedom, they will only choose the thing that is bad for them, not the thing that will do them the most good. So in freedom, the lion, because of its nature, will always choose meat. In our freedom, because of our nature as sinners, we will always choose sin. So I don't really care to debate whether or not we have free will or not free will. It's really a silly discussion, I think, because our free will is the problem. Yeah. It never serves us well because it always chooses badly. Second, we might call it free, but in reality, is it really free if it always chooses in one direction? No. It's a bound will to only operate within the nature that it's housed in. So in relation to its nature, the will that only goes in one direction is not free. It's just the only thing it does. It's a bound will. It's in bondage to sin until God does to it what Jesus did to Lazarus. By his word, just like the word that went out in Genesis 1 over the darkness of the deep and the spirits there hovering, so too the Lord himself descends, becomes one of us, and speaks into the darkness of Lazarus's tomb, and through the work of the Spirit, Lazarus walks out. Life in the midst of death. Light in the midst of darkness. This is what God must do to the will. Perhaps once you see our guilt and darkness and hatred and death and blindness, and that our free will is the problem, that no one is pure in heart, perhaps then we would finally say what the disciples said in Matthew 19:25. Who then can be saved? Remember Jesus' answer? With man, this is impossible. With God, all things are possible. So, remember my encouragement at the start. If you embrace the reality of our depravity, it paves the way for the best news in the world, the gospel of Jesus. Well, before I go there, let me just make one further nuance. Total depravity, I should have put this in, is not the same thing as utter depravity. Do we know the difference of this? Total depravity means the totality of our nature, our being, is fallen. All of us is fallen. Physically, we are fallen. Our parts wear out. Our insides, our outsides wear out. Hair falls out, turns gray. We age and things stop working, etc., etc. Spiritually, we are not what we should be. Every part of us spiritually is also fallen. The totality of us is fallen. Utter depravity means man is as bad as man can possibly be. That's not actually true because we're image bearers. We are not as bad as we actually can be. God has made us in his image. Even Hitler didn't kill his mother. This is the example, right? Things like this. So, if we embrace the reality of our depravity, it paves the way for the best news in the world. How is this true? When God saves, he regenerates our hearts. The old is gone. The new comes. We are new creations. He gives the gift of the new birth and does the impossible, changing our nature to give us for the first time a taste and a desire for the very things that are alien to our natural state. Righteousness, holiness, the beauty of Christ, those are now the things we want. While everything else we recognize is sinking sand in our best moments. There's a struggle here, right, with redeemed man and feeling the pull of the grave we were resurrected from. It's really what sin is, right? When we return to sin, it's a banquet in the grave. Trying to think that we can actually have a feast down there, we were saved out of it. Why would we go back into it and do those things of which we are now ashamed, Paul says. So, the act of sovereign grace, if we're going to use our five terms, that's why I chose the five, because they're reversible in sovereign grace, are all redeemable and reversible with God's power at the moment of salvation or conversion. So we said guilt first, but with the act of sovereign grace, guilt turns to pardon. When God saves, we no longer carry the burden of guilt, but have been pardoned by the blood of Christ, who stood in our place as our substitute on the cross. As Romans 3 says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation and atoning sacrifice by his blood to be received by faith. Guilt by grace moves to pardon. What about darkness? Darkness by grace moves to light. When God saves, we are no longer darkness, but light in the Lord. John 1:4-5. In Christ was life. And the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Or Ephesians 5:8, the verse we looked at before. For at one time you were darkness, But now means there's a shift that happens. There's a redemption that has happened. But now you are light in the Lord. Not you were in darkness, not you're in light. You were darkness, you are light now. So what does Paul say? Walk as children of light, not as children of darkness. By sovereign grace, darkness becomes light. What about hatred? By sovereign grace, hatred becomes love. When God saves, we no longer hate God, we love God. We love Him, 1 John 4:19. We love because He first loved us. Especially this is needed. I'm glad we're having Sunday evening tonight, of all nights, after the morning we had together with such a sobering and heavy text. Because this is one of the litmus, if not the greatest litmus tests of whether you're true or false as a Christian. Do you love the Lord? Is there any love in you for the Lord? That's not of you. That's only of grace. If you find love toward the Lord in you, you're true. Walk in this truth and grow in this love that it's fanned into flame more and more. What about death? By sovereign grace, death turns to life. When God saves, we're no longer dead, but alive. Ephesians 2, we heard 1 to 3, here now 3 to 5. We were by nature children of wrath like the rest of mankind, but God, being rich in mercy because of the great love with which He loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, He made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved. What about blindness? By sovereign grace, blindness turns to sight. When God saves, we are no longer blind. We quoted 2 Corinthians 4, 4 and 5 about how the God of this world blinds the minds of the unbelieving so they can't see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. One more verse gives the remedy in verse 6. For God who said, let light shine out of darkness. That's Genesis 1 that Paul's quoting. Let light shine out of darkness. That God has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So just like God spoke into the darkness in Genesis 1 and created the whole world, each individual conversion moment of each individual sinner, God does a Genesis moment in there. It's almost like a re-Genesis, a new Genesis, where He speaks into the darkness of sin, where there's nothing, you can't see anything, and all of a sudden your eyes are open to see what? To see Jesus, His beauty. We were blind to it, now we can behold it by grace. So, we who were born by nature guilty, loving darkness, living as darkness, hating God, dead in sin, blind to the beauty and the glory of God in the gospel. If you at this moment love God, see His beauty, savor His glory, you are a walking miracle. Fact. So here's my last encouragement. Stop pretending and own the T. Own the total depravity. Martin Luther said this: man is by nature as completely unable to know God as to please God. Let him face the fact and admit it. Let God be God and let man be man. Let ruined sinners stop pretending to be something other than ruined sinners. Let them realize they are helpless in the hand of an angry Creator. Let them seek Christ and cry for mercy and be saved. Church, we are not a people that have problems that are out there that require an inner solution. We are a people that have an inner problem. And the problem comes from outside of us, from the Lord Jesus himself. This is total depravity.